Well, Third Apologist is sort of put together talk show. It's work also. The biggest apology I have, I think, is that this is work that's, in spite of my thinking about it with some collaborators and so on over a period of 5 years, is still in progress, and I still don't have any answers. So it's something that I've been sort of doing in the background, as it were, for a long time and thinking about. And the only compensation that I can think of for not having written papers 5 years ago is that I now know they would have been horribly wrong. So it doesn't stop other people, Okay, so I should at least sort of lay off some of the blame. Art Striker in particular has been extraordinarily patient. Peter Mazaris has become equally frustrated with my inability to actually answer the questions that I think are important in this business. I'm now dragging two graduate students and an undergraduate into the mire. So what I'm going to talk about is some ideas about what might happen when a white dwarf encounters a black hole of intermediate mass. And this, as a theorist, has some attraction, this problem, because white dwarfs are amongst the better understood stars that we know about. So we think we don't understand the physics of white dwarfs, then we're in pretty bad shape speculating about other types of star, including neutron stars, of course. And black holes are even simpler, and as long as we trust in general relativity and the sacred Kerr metric, then we should be in pretty good shape there too. And so in some sense this whole business has a great attraction theoretically, and of course that's what makes it hard to answer the problems, because you actually know what physics to put in. Okay, so here's what I'm going to try and talk about here. Sort of give you sort of the astrophysical premise, which may not be right, so this is just to motivate this. So it may be purely theory, this. Then talk about some possible merger scenarios. Then talk about the about gravitational radiation, white dwarf oscillations and what this might have to do with it, the actual technical problem that I think we actually now understand, although it's a frustration that I haven't been able to present you with results. I think we're about a week away from having some results. We've just got some problems with it. And then something very speculative at the end as to where this may actually lead in terms of observations. So that's the plan. There are many people here, several people I see around, and this is one of my reasons for talking about this subject prematurely, who actually know about different parts of this extremely well and much better than I do. So please ask penetrating questions. You'll be doing me a favor by doing that. Okay, here's the sort of astrophysical premise. The black holes that I'm actually interested in are probably those between stellar size and massive size, that is to say between 10 and a million solar masses. So this is the sort of forbidden range where until recently we had no observations, and so it was a sort of theoretical playground to say that all sorts of objects could be attributed to the activity of this intermediate mass black hole. Now, I don't want to go into this business here, but in fact there has been some evidence from the Chandra observations that there may be some of these intermediate mass black holes around. It's not quite as extensive as you read about in the newspaper, because it turns out the observation was wrong, but nonetheless, there are some hints that there are objects out there that whose X-ray properties can probably be best explained by them having masses of, say, about 10,000 solar masses or so. And from a theoretical point of view, this is not a crazy thing to happen. Because certainly if one thinks about the early universe and the sort of first generation stars, population 3 stars, several numerical simulations are now showing that the first condensed objects might be 1,000, 10,000 solar masses or so. Not absolutely clear, because there's a lot of uncertainties in how that happens. But you could imagine a significant population of black holes in this intermediate range, and if they're not given the opportunity to display in some way, then you would know essentially nothing about it. They're a sort of quintessential dark matter. It's a sort of intermediate range. Okay. Now, the other thing, of course, we know about is there are a lot of white dwarfs around. It's the fate of most stars, including, we imagine, our own, and probably our galaxy, that would contain something between 1 and 10 billion white dwarfs. There have been reports that there are many more of those. The naive interpretation of the Macho, early Macho results, which have now come down a bit, would put this up by probably another factor of 5 or so, but somewhere in this range would be the number of white dwarfs you have. There are fairly strong reasons for believing that those Macho events were not caused by white dwarfs, mainly concerned with nuclear synthesis and so on. But there have also been indications from the Hubble Deep Field, the Proper Motion Survey, for which we await second epoch and so on, there have been claims that there are large numbers of white dwarfs floating around there. So we don't really know how many are, but certainly they're a very common stellar population. So it's not unreasonable on sort of general grounds to imagine there are a lot of encounters between white dwarfs and black holes.
But you do expect more of these kind of encounters than just spiral in from old black hole, low-mass black hole binaries?
Low-mass.
Well, a different form of white dwarf, presumably,
than
would spiral in.
Yeah, that could... I don't know why did I not support it. Okay, that's all theory is not supported here. These are intelligent, these machines. Okay, it's asking better questions than you are. Okay, I don't honestly know the answer to that. I don't know. I mean, it's another route, but I mean, in fact, the theory I'm getting actually works for 10 solar mass black holes and 1.4 solar mass neutron stars as well. But I will try and make plausible to you that the rate is interesting. Okay, so this is a sort of scenario. So there's no sort of concealed or revealed wisdom coming here. This is what you're going to get. Basically, the notion is that in a dense stellar system, you'll capture a white dwarf by a black hole in its intermediate mass range, and it'll form an elliptical orbit. And it will inspiral and circularize, partly through gravitational radiation, but you'll see that's only part of the story. As it spirals in, it has the opportunity of passing through resonances when harmonics of the orbital frequency match frequencies of modes of the white dwarf itself. Okay? And when you do that, and I'll go through this a little bit more, when you do that, then you have the opportunity of taking some of the energy out of the mode and putting it into the white dwarf and exciting reasonable amplitude oscillations in the white dwarf. And in fact, they can be quite large. Here's one with the fundamental frequency is five times the orbital frequency in this case. So this is a little bit. Clearly, in order to do this in a high harmonic, you want to have an elliptical orbit. I think if you think about that for a moment, you need to have power in the harmonics, so that means an elliptical orbit. So that's crucial. Okay, now the excitation of these normal modes can be so good that, and this is what we're really trying to find out, how good it can be, but it looks like it's so good that you can actually get a large amplitude, so it can essentially go nonlinear. And as you, I think you've all OD'd on R modes here. So it's the same sort of considerations. You expect these modes to damp. I have a little bit more to say about how and when that might happen. But if those modes do damp, then they will heat, the energy in the mode will go into the into heat. And that heat, if, for example, the white dwarf has a helium envelope, which is one of the candidates for the type 1A supernovae, it has a sort of helium outer shell, then that can detonate the helium and set off the carbon and oxygen, and essentially, as they say at Los Alamos and so on, they disassemble the whole star. This is, you know, whether or not this happens, this is a sort of more speculative thing at the moment. My guess is it probably would if we got this far. Then you'd have essentially a type 1A supernova or something like that going off at the bottom of a gravitational potential well. The ejector could not escape. They wouldn't be expanding at 10,000 kilometers a second. They'd be stuck there. They'd be orbiting around the black hole and so on. And there are many sort of possible observational manifestations of such a phenomenon. Not supported. Okay. You just know exactly the right time to make that comment. Okay. All right, so I'm going to have some... This is an Institute for Theoretical Physicists, and there's occasionally physicists come in and they think we're all pretty soft in astrophysics. So for their benefit, I've got some formulae here, so they think they'll think that we're really doing science or something. Okay. First thing is, how are you going to capture it? There are basically two capture modes here. And the first one is what I would call gravitational Bremsstrahlung. This is a star on a... Oh. I don't know why it's going narrow there. The arrow's going the wrong way. Okay. It should go this way. This is a time reversal of the thing. It's on an unbound orbit, this star. Slightly funny orbit, actually. Think of it in perspective. Yeah, okay. This right thing, it comes around, swings around Perihelion, and then in this passage around the black hole here, it will radiate gravitational radiation. And this is why I would call it Bremsstrahlung. It's just when it swings by. That's when the classical gravitational radiation is being created. And if you radiate enough energy in that passage, you'll convert the orbit from an unbound orbit to a bound orbit. And these are the sort of standard formulae for the energy that's released during this passage, and then the angular momentum that's released. And it's energy and angular momentum that are kind of important in this problem. This isn't just a question of energy. One has to pay attention to the angular momentum too. And so just note here, don't have to remember any of this, but note that the angular momentum is related to the energy. You'd expect it to be some multiple of the angular frequency, but the angular frequency is the maximum angular frequency in the orbit. Okay, so if n is an angular frequency following celestial mechanical principles or something, then this is the maximum angular frequency in the orbit. And so relative to the total angular frequency for the orbit, the average mean daily motion, whatever they call it, for the total orbit, then there's very little angular momentum taken out. And so these are very good at taking out energy, not so good at taking out angular momentum, which is the fundamental reason why things remain more elliptical than you might have guessed. The cross-section for this is written here in immediately transparent units per cubic parsec. Sigma V is per cubic parsec per year. Trust me, it can happen. Basically, what this means is that in basically two scenarios, and not taking into account Martin's suggestion, which may happen too, two scenarios. One is in a galactic nucleus. For example, in a dwarf galaxy. We don't know where the nuclear, most of the Magellanic Clouds or other dwarf galaxies are, but it's not unreasonable that there might be in the central regions one or a few 10 to the 4th solar mass or 10 to the 5th solar mass black holes. And there's lots of dwarf galaxies. There's, of course, 100 billion of those, as far as we can tell. So there are lots of dwarf galaxies out there, and so they may have low mass black holes in their nuclei. Every time I speculate, they does that. And characteristic speeds might be tens of kilometers a second or so, and the cross section is such that to get an event rate throughout the universe of one per day, and this is sort of normalized to sort of gamma ray burst type event rates, is quite plausible, I think. The other possibility is that you get many more of these as one part of the dark matter in the halos of galaxies. This turns out, although you might have, say, 10,000 10 to the 5th solar mass black holes or something in the halo of our galaxy, there's no reason why you shouldn't have that. I mean, there's no observational constraint on that. And let's say if these things were made in the early universe, that wouldn't be, too bad a guess. And they could also encounter white dwarfs and so on. Although there'd be many more of them, the cross sections go down because the velocities are higher and the densities are lower.
I would add globular clusters.
Globular clusters,
so you probably have 100
yep.
solar mass
yep.
per hole.
Yes, no, that's right. I meant to put that in there, globular clusters too. Thank you. That also is another possibility. Not sure how that compares with galactic nuclei. We don't know what's going on in the dwarf galaxies, but it's certainly a reasonable possibility. So thanks, that's good. Thanks for bringing that up. Anyway, so that's a reasonable capture cross-section.
How close do we have to get compared to the solid radius?
Excuse me?
How close
did it happen? Well, basically, if you want the impact parameter, it depends on...
I'm curious about the capture cross-section compared to the collision cross-section.
These will typically capture on an orbit that's becoming relativistic at closest approach. It'll turn out that this gravitational Bremsstrahlung is only operative for the higher mass black holes, for the ones over about 10 to the 5th solar masses. Under those circumstances, Perry boson is few m. This is a relativistic problem. We know what to do. I mean, at least I know what to do in principle to do the relativistic problem. I'll chase some issues that Scott Hughes will one day sort out. But what I'm talking about here is purely a non-relativistic approach. I don't think that's crucial, in fact. I think the major things are sort of non-relativistic problems, but it can be done relativistically. It will have to be done eventually. So that's, again, these are all thanks. These are all good questions. Okay, I had some graphs here, but I couldn't actually bring them up. So again, you'll have to just trust me. If you just have gravitational radiation and nothing else going on, it turns out that the angular velocity of the orbit evolves with eccentricity in this way. That's just the integral of the Peters and Matthews formulae. That's the only thing that's going on. Not instantly obvious, but there it is. And the upshot of all of this is that the orbits can remain quite eccentric as they spiral in from typical. Basically, when you've got a capture, you've got an unbound white dwarf. It swings around the black hole first time around, according to gravitational radiation formulae. Radiates some gravitational radiation, is then on a bound orbit with a certain energy and angular momentum, and then subsequently, in subsequent passages, it just spirals in, circularizing somewhat, but basically when it gets down to the point when it's going to have resonances that might be interesting, the eccentricities can still be 0.2 or so, they can still be substantial. It hasn't become, under this scenario, it hasn't become a very circular orbit. So that's crucial to getting any energy into the mode. Okay, a little bit about white dwarf oscillations here. Again, just this is sort of a big interesting. Yuan Ching Wu and so on is a great expert on this. The modes that we're in, so probably the most important mode is the Helmholtz mode or the F mode. This is the one that's sort of the compromise between the G modes, which normally exist in a star but don't exist in a cold white dwarf. A cold white dwarf, there's no buoyancy, so there's no G modes. And then there's the P modes, which are all rather too high frequency to be of direct interest, although there might be some indirect interest. But there's effectively no G modes in a cold white dwarf. Well, I'll come back to the point of what happens when you heat up the white dwarf, because then you have got G modes, and there might be some good for this.
No G modes? It's crystallized?
No. If it's cold, there's no buoyancy. Essentially, if I compress the star here, it's just the same as moving it there. There's no buoyancy, no bump isolated frequency, if you like.
They take a Hubble time to cool down.
Sure. And so they're not completely cold.
Right.
And so there are G modes. And then, for example, has modelled the modes associated with ZZ SETI stars, which you can see going on, but they're mainly confined in the non-degenerate regions on the surface. Okay, we're interested in body modes that go throughout the star. Now, it turns out, and this is what one of the undergraduate who was working with us was computing these things over the summer, and slightly to my surprise, I'm now beginning to think the G modes may in fact be some use at the sort of temperatures we're talking about. We're talking about high internal temperatures eventually. So if the white dwarf gets really hot, then the G modes may actually be some interest. So, but I'm not going to say, I've not got that far yet.
But if the G mode frequency is low, then. You'll get into resonance earlier.
That's the point. That's why they could be interesting. But if they're only sort of fluff on the surface, they may be very important for observations because you can actually see these things. But if there's no eigenfunction that's going into the interior, then they're not going to be used for heating the star. You've got to get the degenerate part of the star heated if you want to set up a nuclear explosion. So. I wasn't going to talk about this, but what was actually discovered was that these modes actually do have a lot of meat in the interior. So more than I would have guessed. So anyway, you have to deal with a set of modes. And so, for example, just to give some idea, it's 0.6 radians per second for the sort of fundamental one. This is the one with L equals 2 and M equals 2. Dealing with a non-rotating white dwarf at the moment. It will, of course, typically be rotating, and that'll break the degeneracy and so on. But just try and understand the simpler problem first. So this one here, this is the most L equals 2 because you're talking about tidal excitation and so on. People who've done this sort of thing have generally sort of done things with polytropes and so on and use the Cowling approximation, which essentially ignores gravity. It turns out for this particular mode, that's a rather dangerous thing. I don't want to belabor this point, but that's a rather dangerous thing to do, actually, because it's rather misleading. Most modes it's set fine, but in this case it isn't.
You get the wrong coupling?
Sorry?
The wrong coupling coefficient?
Well, I mean, it's just inaccurate. It's quite inaccurate. It's a property of the F mode. It's not well described in the Cowling approximation. The P modes and the G modes and so on are just fine. But this one is the one that's not well described, that's all. And that may actually matter. So it's not harder to do it, but it's not hard to put in the graph. You've just got four equations, not two equations, that's all. Okay. Obviously, you're concerned about the Roche limit. You don't want the star to be torn apart as it swings by periboson. And so that essentially what that translates to into is, depending on the white dwarf mass, an upper bound in black holes of interest of about 1 million solar masses. Okay, so that's roughly what it is for this sort of process. Okay, now, there's a sort of point here, a technical point, that I think this is right, although we haven't actually completely satisfactorily persuaded ourselves of this, but I think it's right. If you've got a mode in a white dwarf, it has a certain energy, you can compute the energy associated with the mode. That's a fairly straightforward thing to do. There's a sort of formula you can derive for what the modal energy is. There's also a formula for the angular momentum, but it's a little slightly perplexing when you actually look at it. And I think it has to be true that the angular momentum that you put into a mode is related to the energy you put into the mode by the azimuthal quantum number divided by the frequency. So this omega over m is essentially the pattern frequency. It's the angular frequency of the pattern in this case. The thing is just going round. As the star goes round, the pattern goes around. And I think that has to be generically true. You can see a sort of thought experiment where you have a gravitating mass on a track where you make it go round at the pattern frequency and go around in a circle. And you just make it go around in a circle on the pattern frequency in a mechanical track. And then the torque is related to the rate of doing work and so on by this ratio. And so that seems to be a fundamental problem, but it's because we're concerned about how the energy and the angular momentum are evolving, we've got to get that right.
Roger, is that also true if the mode is being dissipated?
Sorry?
Is that also true?
In the weak limit, yes. Because we're talking about we've got tens of thousands of orbits to do this. Okay. We're not supported. Okay.
You're limiting your consideration only to those stars that don't get tidally disrupted, but tidal disruption is, of course, just the extreme case of
this. Is the extreme case of this, yes.
It's just you don't get much heat in that tidal disruption to actually explode the star, or...
Well, if you just have the tidal disruption, basically what you do, as in there's been a sort of modest industry of SPH-type calculations of stars swinging by black holes and being ripped apart by tidal forces. And it's the same principle, basically, for a white dwarf capture as for a stellar mass capture, say, onto a 10 million solar mass black hole. And that gives you no extra energy. See, what I'm interested in is making something interesting happen at the bottom of the gravitational potential well.
So why does exciting the F mode give you extra energy, is what I'm asking.
Why? Oh, well it just puts energy into the mode. That's not much energy compared with the work that will be done by tidal forces.
Yes.
But if you then damp that energy,
yes,
then you light the blue touch paper and stand clear and the thing's going to explode. So it's really harnessing the nuclear energy that we're about. Let me put it the following way. The binding energies, when we start off with the orbital binding energies, they're like 100 electron volts per nucleon or something like that when we start, and then they get more and more, and get kV per nucleon. The energy associated with the oscillation, when it becomes nonlinear, might be something like 100 kV per nucleon. well, more like 30 kb, actually more like 30 kb per nucleon in the mode. And then you want to make that become something like half an MeV per nucleon, which is what you'll get from nuclear reactions. And that's enough to unbind the star.
Right.
Whereas the oscillation, obviously by its very nature, does not unbind the star. So what we're really doing is having less energy than you would associate with a with a tidal event. So we have less energy.
You continually heat, and
because we continually heat, and then we have the opportunity of releasing the nuclear energy.
And you don't have that heating in a tidal disruption because it happens too quickly.
Right, it happens too quickly, so it just disassembles. There's no. In fact, there's a fire.
Yeah.
Hi. You did a calculation of something around about 10 solar mass, and you found almost no nuclear physics going on. I think was.
Yeah. The problem is if you have exactly what you said, it's just one brief moment. It expands and it doesn't heat up that much.
Yeah.
That would be true for a white dwarf too.
This
is a white dwarf.
It was a white dwarf. Yeah.
Not then.
Yeah. Okay. So just to sort of say what the competition with gravitational bremsstrahlung, and this is an old process, and everyone here I suspect is aware of it. It was invented by Fabian et al. In I think 1975. They said 77, it should have been 75, I think, and then it was calculated very nicely. There's actually one small mistake there by Preston Tucholsky that was cleared up later. And then the basic point is that we don't get tidal disruption, but in the first pass around the black hole, or it could be a neutron star, and the first passage, then you get modes excited. Essentially, you've got all Fourier components, essentially, so all modes in principle can be excited to some degree, and that represents an extraction of energy from the orbit. And that extraction of energy from the orbit means that the orbit can now become bound, and that's all been worked out in great detail. And I think the bottom line is now, they want to correct me here, that this is now thought to be less important in globular clusters than it was originally thought to be the case, and we're basically doing more conventional stellar dynamics and so on in globular clusters after all. But still, the process I think was correctly worked out, and you know, it could have been important. Something that Ray Halleck Ray and others pointed out was, well, I guess it was sort of known, but they pointed out it was very important, was that there was subsequent passages were going to lead to more heating, and so if you had a star going around a compact object, then you would have a lot of heating of that star, and you'd likely drive up a lot of mass off the star, and this is actually quite an important process. Basically, what happens, and this is just the bottom line of just doing these calculations, is that under typical conditions, it's only the high-mass holes that are going to be captured through gravitational bremsstrahlung. The lower-mass ones are captured through tidal effects. And as the...
should be the other way around?
Tidal capture dominates... Yes, the inequality is reversed. Thank you very much. Okay. Okay, that inequality is not supported. Okay. sorry, thank you. I'm maybe other mistakes. Okay, now I want to something completely different. I apologize for returning to the simple harmonic oscillator, but I've yet actually to encounter anybody who actually knew this. I'm rather a physicist. Okay. You've seen this...
You're being recorded,
right? Yes, I know. I'm... it's obvious when you say it, but if you ask the question in an obscure enough way, you can kid yourself they didn't understand it. Okay, so you've seen this equation before, I think. This is a simple harmonic oscillator, and we've got some acceleration here, for example. Okay, and let's suppose that we a little demonstration you can do with a couple of pendulum and so on, where you shorten the length of one of the pendula and you have one big thing oscillating backwards and forwards, and as you shorten the length you go through resonance and you transfer some of the energy out of the big bob into the little bob. And so this is, we've got some sort of forcing function here, and so as we go, if we just imagine how much energy we might transfer to the mode as we go through resonance, it turns out it's given by this formula here, ready to the Fourier transform of the acceleration. And so, for example, if you had something like an oscillator here that's driving this oscillator with its own natural frequency, where the frequency is slowly changing. This omega dot is small. As we just go through resonance, then what we see is something like that. And the astronomers here might recognize this and say, hey, that looks like a Cournot spiral. And if you set up the problem right, it is exactly a Cournot spiral. So it's just like straight edge diffraction. This is basically similar to straight edge diffraction and so on. And the point is that you actually get the energy going into the oscillation this way. And this is how much you put into the oscillation. And the energy per unit mass, if you like, goes as A naught. It's actually calculated. You can calculate it, but it's sort of hypergeometric things and so on. But it's A naught squared over omega prime, basically, times the number of order unity, depending on quite how you set this phase function up. And the time that it takes to go through resonance, essentially this time here, you know, the same sort of deal as you do with Fresnel and so on, goes to the inverse square root of the rate of change of angular frequency. And the thing that sort of question is, you might say, well, what happens if there's damping going on? What if I put a gamma psi dot in that equation there, or two gamma psi dot in that equation? How much energy? How does that change the energy? And this is the thing that I think people have to know, is it doesn't change it at all, as long as you do this on a sort of reasonable, you don't damp it on, you aren't critically damped or anything. So the point is that if you damp very slowly, then you'll excite a large oscillation in going through the resonance. You've gone through resonance, you've got a large oscillation, and then in the course of time, this will slowly damp and go into heat. Alternatively, if gamma is significant compared with the time scale for going through resonance, then you get to a much smaller amplitude, but for a longer period, you're putting energy into heat in the oscillation. The damping term is doing work and dissipating. So it turns out to be independent of the rate of damping, how much energy you put into the oscillation in these simple problems. So this is the process that's essentially where, this is a metaphor, if you like, for the orbital transfer of orbital energy to oscillation energy. Okay, so I'm basically, if you do the problem, which is the sort of simplest one to do, and it's not right, this problem, I have to tell you, it's not right, but if you do the problem of just have the orbit evolve under gravitational radiation, and then just let it proceed in its merry way, down, in spiraling in, and then treat it as a driven oscillator, and figure out how much energy goes into the mainly the F2 mode, but some of the other ones may be actually, as I said, may actually be more important, but the F2 one's an easy one to deal with. Then the sort of resonances you have are something like the third harmonic, I don't know whether second harmonic or third harmonic, you know, S equals, there's always this debate as to whether that's second or third harmonic, but whatever it is. But that's the sort of typical circumstance you have. The orbit is still quite eccentric, and there's an integral around the orbit, and you know, if you've got 0.2, 0.3 or something like that, then in this case you've actually got enough energy transfer. You've got sort of thousands of orbits basically you're dealing with here, because there's a large mass ratio, so you've got thousands of orbits, and you can get a significant amount of energy into the mode. And basically there's a sort of overlap integral for what the tidal force is doing, and overlapping that with the nature of the mode inside the star. And as I said, the slower you go through resonance, the more the energy transfer. So the higher the mass ratio, the more the energy transfer. Again, I'm not going to go through every case and so on, but basically if you do this calculation, which is wrong, you end up with nonlinear modes. Even though you're going into harmonics. And it's basically because there's a lot more energy in the orbit than there is in the stellar mode. Okay. Now, the reason why it's wrong is that we've ignored the back reaction. We can't just treat this as a driven oscillator. While the star is moving around and exciting the oscillation in the white dwarf, while the orbit is there, you're taking energy out of the orbit and putting it into the white dwarf, while that is going on, that mode in the white dwarf is exerting a tidal force on the orbit and putting a back reaction into the orbit. So you actually have to do a celestial mechanical calculation to figure out how the orbit is responding to the white dwarf, and the two have got to be, you know, done self-consistently. And the net effect of that is to reduce the time at resonance, but in fact what it does is it broadens the resonance. So in some sense it you get through resonance faster, but you broaden the resonance in a sort of dynamical sense, so you end up still with a fair amount of energy put into the mode. But I don't quite know the answer as to whether or not the modes are driven nonlinear at this point. I think they are, but that's based on having done, you know, stuff, things on the computer and run lots of partial differentials, lots of ODEs and integrate them up, and the answer was yes, but I'm not sure I trust, we understand them completely yet to be confident that this is what's going on. Technical point here, the standard way of doing the Fabian et al. Thing that people have used since then by Bessel and Tucholsky and so on, sort of, just like quantum mechanics, was basically an energy formalism. It told you how much energy went into the mode. In this case, that's not good enough. You've got to keep the phase of the oscillation. The phase of the oscillation drifts through resonance, you know, the UA method in optics. You're familiar with this sort of thing in optics. So the phase of the oscillation goes through resonance, changes through resonance, and you've got to keep track of that, because the orbit itself, of course, is precessing as well. So you've actually got to keep track of the phase, and for that reason, you've got to consider the amplitude with it as a complex number. You've got to track that as you go through resonance, and so this is basically the amplitude of the mode here. Is just expressed as a sum over eigenfunctions here, integrated over mass, and then with respect to time, through the through the interaction, and this grad phi here is essentially the tidal part of the force that's actually doing the exciting. And you know, it doesn't have to be the L equals 2 mode, though I'm pretty confident that it's the L equals 2 modes that are the most important, because they're the ones that have the greatest meat in the tidal force. But you know, full expansion has all values of L there, but I think they're just not contributing. So that's my guess, but I'm not even sure. And then, as I say, we've also got to get the back reaction on the orbit, so we have to actually keep track of the orbital elements as we go through this calculation. And where we are at the moment is a working program, but I'm not actually sure that I trust the output as yet, so I'm not sure what the answer. So I'm not sure whether or not the modes are, the real question is, under what circumstances, if any, are the modes driven nonlinear? If they're never driven nonlinear in this correct way of thinking about it, then I think we can sort of close the book on this. We don't have to get the rest of the speculative stuff is not necessary. Question.
So Rosemary Marlin, a number of years ago, considered the interaction between the modes of the orbit for stars.
That's just the sort of intelligence that I was keen on. Tell me who.
Rosemary Margolin.
Margolin.
And she considered, she actually took the limit that the stars, I guess, dissipation was, but kept track of all the phases, was able to construct solutions in which, after tidal capture, and the stars started vibrating, if you will, the energy was fed back into the orbit, and the star was detached as a result of gaining the energy that it had gone into.
Yeah. The nice thing is that she has some kind of eccentricity amplitude diagram where you can instantly see whether this thing is going chaotic, so you have no hope of knowing what's going to happen really, or whether it's still
So who is this? This is not
Rosemary Marlin. It's the same thing.
Rosemary Marlin. She wrote two papers.
Okay.
This is Monash.
But it was all based on a start that
idealized
extremely high Q.
Yeah, okay.
So I would expect to see anything like that in this Q, so it's reasonably small. So
dissipation approach.
Okay, well, that's not a reference, I know, but I obviously ought to read that. So where can I find that?
I'll find it.
Okay, thank you. That's made this worthwhile. Okay, so that's great. Okay, so you're the first person to actually draw that to our attention, so that's great. So we'll have to see if that formalism looks like what we're doing. Okay, good.
So Roger, I understand you pass through the resonance pass if you include orbital evolution, but you said the title is resonance broadening. So why is the resonance broadened as well?
Oh, it's just essentially that you pass through the resonance faster because you're taking energy and angular momentum out of the orbit by not just through gravitational radiation happen passively, but taking it actively out to pump up the oscillation.
Because I understand resonance broadening as saying, you're saying the mode actually has a broadened profile with respect to.
No, all I mean is that if you, if we, let's back up a,
The
response. Why is it not? There we are, this is the one. There's a certain characteristic time here in which there's an energy transfer from the orbit to the oscillation. If that's a characteristic time. That time, the characteristic time that you go through resonance will be shorter. You go through that angular frequency, if you like, will be shorter, because you're taking energy out of the orbit and putting it into the oscillation. But in fact, the width of the resonance, you know, just in terms of the width of the resonance, will be larger than that.
You mean by resonance broadly the kind of thing where the for finite amplitude you land up both shifting and changing the actual frequency, natural frequency?
Yes, not of the oscillation. But what's happening is that you're changing the orbit. The oscillation is still the same. In this formalism, there's no nonlinearity in the oscillation. That's a mass on a spring doing that. Okay? But what is happening is that the angular frequency of the orbit is not evolving in the regular way that it would if it were just being driven by gravitational radiation. When it gets near a resonance, it goes faster. And in fact, the orbit does very funny things near resonance.
I was scratching my head because resonance broadening.
No. Okay, I would not. Yes, I should have known that plasma physicists here, resonance broadening does mean something different, and that's not what I'm talking about here. Okay, I should not have used that expression. Well, I apologize.
There's also another effect, namely, when you transfer energy to the mode, the rotation rate of the star is changing. So the mode.
Right. You will actually, because you're giving some energy to the star, you're actually starting it spinning. Yes, but in practice I think that's going to be relatively small, and the reason why is because, you know, this is much better at taking energy than angular momentum out of the orbit. So in fact you really don't get the star spinning very fast, I think, this way. So certainly one has to do the problem where the star doesn't spin at all first, but I mean that's an additional complication. At the same way that general relativity is an additional complication.
Can you estimate the damping time of the mode? How does it compare to the orbital period?
Well, I'll come on to that. Maybe you've got some more ideas about that. Okay, so there's various ways in which these modes may be damped, and. The short answer is this is very hard to do from just sort of thinking about it, but the one thing you can calculate, and that may be part of the implication of the G-modes, is you can do a parametric excitation of G-modes, and that's a process that Kumar and somebody else, Kumar and Goodman actually calculated for a different type of star, but it basically would be the same process. And that might be one way of taking energy out, and then the energy could go from the G modes and could get spread around many modes, and then probably some inverse cascade or whatever, and then eventually go into heat. I'm not sure how that would go eventually, but it might be one way of doing this. Another possibility is you might excite turbulence, particularly if there's a density discontinuity in the interior of the white dwarf. That might be a good place of exciting some turbulence. The third possibility that I sort of like is that, and I'm not sure if this really works, is to build up a tsunami. I have a colleague who has promised to compute, if we give him some initial conditions, which we're almost at the point of being able to do, promised to compute this in a finite difference thing to see what happens to one of these modes, if you could actually make it break. And in which case, if it did break, then it would certainly heat the star, and you get a very rapid transfer into heat. There's no question of that. So I don't actually know what's going to happen here. It may be one outcome of this is that there is a lot of energy put into the mode, but it just stays in the mode, and then it goes into, it's just a vibrating white dwarf that goes into the black hole, and nothing else ever happens. That's certainly one possible outcome. But if the energy of the oscillation is sort of something like this. Then basically you can take the temperature up to about 10 to the 8th degrees or so, And if there's helium on the surface, it can detonate. It's not absolutely clear to me that if it were just a carbon oxygen white dwarf, which needs a higher, around about 500 million degrees to detonate a carbon oxygen white dwarf. I'm not sure that that will go. I'm not sure there's ever likely to be enough energy to do that. I think helium could certainly go. I'm not absolutely sure about that.
So it detonates on the surface then. So it's like a sub-Chandrasekhar detonation? Is that something where you have helium that you detonate?
Yes. I mean, there are basically two models for type 1A supernovae, as I understand, with enthusiastic advocates. One is that you have a 1.4 solar mass one that basically goes pop in the center, where the densities are quite high. And the other is you have an off-center explosion, where you have a helium envelope, which is sort of easier to ignite, and that's essentially the fuse for most of the nuclear fuel.
Yeah, that latter, which is what you want, is the one that somehow the advocate.
I think that's easier to do. I'm not sure that you can't do the other one, but my guess is you can't. My guess is you'll never have enough energy in the oscillation to get the temperature up that high. But perhaps you can at 1.4 solar mass white. The 1.4 solar mass white dwarfs. We've mainly sort of fixated on 0.6 solar mass white dwarfs because there's more of those. But maybe you can do for 1.4. I don't know. I mean, as I say, I have no answers for you. Into sort of freewheeling speculative mode at this point. So let's go through. This is your third seminar of the day or something. So I apologise for that. So let's just get through this quickly. I mean, this is all blindingly obvious to all of you, I think. So if you have basically the binding energy, this is sort of an instructive calculation actually. Is like just compute the binding energy in the sort of stellar structure sense of a white dwarf. And it varies, if I did the sum right, and got the two factor of two right and so on, between 0.04 and 0.2 MeV per nucleon as you go from 0.6 to 1.4 solar masses. And if you were going to get essentially the whole star and you're going to burn carbon and oxygen to completion, and it's by no means clear that these reactions would do that, you've got at best 0.7 MeV per nucleon. And this is, so it's a bit touchy, you haven't got a lot of energy to spare to explain that. And have the ejector escape with 10,000 kilometers a second. So it's certainly is instructive, just doing the simple comparison. It was to me. I'm sure that Nemota and all these other people understand this completely. But that's why they have to work so hard to make it work, because it's just touch and go. And so if you only had sort of partial, only a third of the star or something, you'd never do it. So 1 to 2 times 10. Kelvin is what's needed, and then of course you have this if it's happening with a say 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5, 10 to the 6 solar mass black hole, then this happens right at the bottom of the potential well. Could happen indeed in the ergosphere. I mean, again, you'd have to do a proper relativistic calculation, I suppose, eventually, but just to get the general principle, it'd be right down the bottom. And that sort of might be interesting in many different ways. You have, obviously, you're going to have this explosion, so you create a lot of gas on a whole lot of different orbits, and that differentially processes very rapidly. The streams rotate, and they intersect and dissipate. Maybe they'll make a disk. Maybe they'll wind up magnetic fields. From the usual...
Every time this happens, it's...
Sorry?
It's not in a wide eccentric...
When this happens, this will happen... probably around Perry-Bothon in a sort of modestly eccentric orbit, eccentricities of 0.2 or 0.3 or something like that, maybe. And so, and then you could make waving ones. You generally amplify field past this by waving your hands at a large rate. There's an argument you can give that says that in principle, you can sort of imagine under these circumstances where all the streams are differentially rotating, so essentially in two dimensions you're sort of having things crossing over. You can have the field go as n to the nth rather than exponentially, so you can actually sort of go even faster than exponentially. And so, five orbits essentially would build up a dynamically intolerable field. And the other thing, of course, is that if you've got a black hole there, you can actually release more energy, in principle, from the spin of the hole. Than you would do from the mere white dwarf itself. In principle, you've got that to tap. So this is sort of a range of complete speculation, and I'm not sure this has got anything to do with a long duration gamma ray burst. Perhaps not, but the frequency could be comparable. The time scale I think can be short enough, and you can actually make some sort of model of gamma ray bursts with that's rather different from the standard blast wave model. I'm not sure it has any much to commend it, but and if you believe that you can make short time scales in the emission, you could make some sort of alternative thing along these lines, but not absolutely sure how relevant that is. Where are we? What happened there? Didn't understand that. Click to end presentation. That wasn't quite the end of the presentation. Okay. It's telling me I've said enough. I mean, this is a very smart machine. It's certainly not my laptop. I think it's something in there that's doing this. Okay. The only other thing I was going to say. Okay. One more thing I was going to say. That was, this might, of course, be also be a consideration for LISA, which is this proposed gravitational radiation observatory from space, and one of the prime targets would be white dwarf captures onto black holes. And generally speaking, people have been diligently computing templates and so on and working out noise, assuming that everything spirals in under gravitational radiation. If you have all these hiccups as you go through resonances, that's on the one hand going to make your signal extraction very much harder, because you don't get to follow some simple evolution of the orbit. But on the other hand, if you could actually do it, then it would give you more information, because seeing the resonance, being able to do the spectroscopy, would tell you the masses of the bodies involved and so on, because all this is in principle calculable. Anyway, so let me finish at that point. Thank you very much.
Guaranteed to have the astrophysicists muddy the waters with the relativists.
Yes, I think that's doesn't always happen. The binary pulsar was a counterexample. I mean, they tried their hardest, but they failed. They basically were unable to dirty a clean physics experiment, but they did try. Okay.
Black hole has to be
425.
A car black hole?
Sorry?
The black hole.
Oh, no. In fact, that's a very good point, Sashiko. It doesn't have to be a Kerr black hole. But in fact, if it's prograde, and of course half of them will be prograde and half will be retrograde, if it's prograde, you're of course getting closer. So in that sense, there's something more likely interesting to happen in a prograde capture around a Kerr hole than around a Schwarzschild hole. So that's a good point, yeah. So I'm sure the more interesting events will happen around a Kerr hole. Mm-hmm.
Is there any chance that when the mode goes along linear, it evolves in such a way that without any dissipation, you still get a limiting value to the mode, just because it acts on the orbit in such a way that you won't cause the mode to grow further?
Yes, I mean that's exactly the point. That's why we're sweating blood to try and do the coupled evolution, because it may well be that if the reaction back on the orbit limits the energy transfer. But I think it's one of these things where we may ultimately develop some physical insight into what's going on, but at the moment we don't really have a good understanding. We're just sort of integrating things up and seeing what comes out the other end. But I think I'd like to have a better understanding of what was tugging at what inside in terms of the orbit. But that is, you know, one possible outcome is that under all circumstances that you never get a large amplitude of oscillation, in which case the rest of the sort of story becomes irrelevant.
I thought the Rosemary Mountain reserves, when the mode she's using is a polyunity amplitude already.
Well, it's linear, completely linear. It starts at low amplitude and grows, and she gets the calculation to a point that becomes non-linear.
Well, I mean, obviously I've got to read this paper, so it sounds highly relevant.
The result of that paper is very artificial. If you don't have any damping, you get this chaotic behavior. but it's a very misleading result.
Yeah, well, there is damping because of gravitation. Remember, there's gravitational radiation going on here.
I think at these eccentricities, they are not in our chaotic regime at all. I think there's an eccentricity of 0.2, so that would only prove that it's actually not too bad.
Did you have gravitational radiation in there?
No.
Okay, well, that's important because the gravitational is what's driving this resonance in the first place.
She has, of course, tidal coupling in there.
Oh, okay,
She gets the capture by tidal.
Yeah, then I think it's not the same. It's not the same thing. Because it's just, you've got to have the gravitational radiation to drive it remorselessly through resonance. And so it'll be a significantly different problem. It's not a Hamiltonian problem under those circumstances. I won't be around tomorrow, yeah.
Okay,
sorry.
So Roger, through the rest of the day and some of tomorrow is sitting somewhere in the way.
Yeah.
Great, thanks.
Okay, thank you. Yeah.